This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Marion Spencer was born in 1920 in Gallipolis, Ohio, 1 year after the Red Summer of 1919 that saw a surge in race riots and lynchings. Following the example of her grandfather, an ex-slave and community leader, she joined the NAACP at age 13 and grew up to achieve not only a number of civic leadership firsts here in her adopted home of Cincinnati, but a legacy of lasting civil rights victories. Ohio University Press has just released the biography, Keep On Fighting, The Life and Civil Rights Legacy of Marion A. Spencer, written by Dorothy Christensen and Dot. Marion, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation.
Marion, what was your reaction to today's Supreme Court ruling that legalized same-sex marriage across the U.S.?
I was happier than I've been in a long time. I was so grateful because I was fearful ahead of time what could happen. And people didn't understand what the president has been trying to tell them for a long, long time, and which I hope now after maybe, 50 times they voted on it, they actually have done, and they have a leader who understands why.
Okay, and you're talking about the Affordable Care Act,
That's
correct?
Right, that the one, Affordable okay? Care Act.
You were glad to see that decision.
Oh, yes, I was so glad to see it passed.
Okay, and then today they decided that same-sex marriage would be legal across the U.S. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I think there are reasons for that, and I think that we have approached them. My identical twin sister doesn't think quite like that. She thinks that it should not be. I think that it should be because it's not up for us to say. I think it's for people to make those decisions, and I think that legally we have no right to change them.
And you see, this is just another step forward in advancing people's rights.
And independence, yes.
Now, you became part of the struggle for civil rights when you were just 13 years old. You joined the NAACP. I mean, that's just incredible.
Well, you know, they sent people around to the various communities, and I think it cost 50 cents if you were a child and a dollar if you were an adult to join. And I remember my father saying very clearly, yes, I and every member of my family will be a member of this organization. And we all were. There were four children and four adults, and we were all members.
So your family was very focused on civil rights.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. My dad and my grandfather got up and gave all of us a sermon every morning. He said, get your education. And then his second statement was, and vote. He said it's important.
Yeah.
And he allowed his store, that he owned and operated, to be used as a polling place every year. And I looked through the cracks and saw the people pulling those curtains behind their backs. And I said, when I grow up, I'm going to do that. I've never missed voting in my life.
Yeah, voting is important. I think it's a lot of people take it
for granted.
Oh, in a
democracy, you must vote.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people today take it for granted.
Yeah, they don't appreciate the real equality there that's there. Yeah,
one of the things that her grandfather said about voting was that the ballot box is the only place that color doesn't matter. Nobody knows what color the vote was.
Yeah. Don, he was a smart man.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And education and voting were the two big things.
Education and voting were the two big things.
Yeah. Dot, how did you become involved in writing Marion's story?
Well, I've known Marion since 1970 when I moved to Cincinnati, and I was quite appalled at the racial steering I got when I was looking for a house near the university. And so I looked for a fair housing agency, and the year before, Marion was a founder of Housing Opportunities Made Equal. So I became a volunteer, and for a while I was a board member there, and Marion was on the board, as still is on the board. And so I've known her, and then we've worked together on charter. When she ran for city council, I was working for Bobby Stern, and so I helped with her campaign, and I helped set up her office, and we've just been good friends ever since. And I said to her one day in 2012, Marion, you've got to write down some of these stories. And she said, well, how? So I said if she would give the time to it, that I would record the stories and type them up and give them back. And we did an earlier version of the book for her family for Christmas.
Oh, what a great gift.
Christmas presents.
Yeah, I wrote down all the stories that she had told, and then I sent it to Ohio University Press, and and said, is this a book? And they said, not yet. You've got to add a lot more context around what the situations were that she was involved with. And so that's what I did.
Well, that explains the format of the book. When you look at it, you have a lot of narrative about what was going on at the time and what the facts were, and then you have Marion's reaction to it. So that was why you chose to write it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Marion, I saw a handbill. Dot was talking about your city council days. It was from a city council campaign, and I appreciated the honesty of it because it said, I don't have all the answers, but I have new ideas that I'd like to put to work in Cincinnati. You were on city council from 1983 until 1985 as a charter.
Two-year terms, yeah. And I was a charter candidate, and I had wonderful people working with me, beginning with my husband, who could anything you ask him to do, he did well. And when I asked him to help me, he would always say, "Of course." We had 70 wonderful years of marriage, and I'm so grateful that God was good.
I had the pleasure of meeting your husband one time. He is a splendid man.
He's a good man.
Yeah. How did you meet him?
Well, it was interesting. My twin sister and I were both on campus, and she had met a young man who was, he and Donald had been going together organize a chapter of Kappa Alpha Psi on campus, and they were best friends. He was dating my sister, and I think I got in his hair because I didn't approve of him. And so we couldn't stay on the campus at the time, and we were living with pharmacy owners who were relatives of my father. And we had to walk to UC every day. And when Millie's boyfriend decided that I was interfering with their relationship, he brought Donald, his best friend, to the pharmacy to meet me. We married before they did. We fell in love, and it didn't take long to make a decision. In fact, I told him, I said, you know, you asked me to marry you the second time you took me out. He said, did I really? And he really did. But it took us a while. He had to meet my parents, and they had to set a wedding date. And when I changed it, Dad said, shouldn't have changed it. So that made Dad a little angry, but we got married on schedule at the end of my sophomore year at UC, and we had 70 years of marriage.
And he was perfect because you both had the same convictions and passions about civil rights.
We talked about difficult things before we married. We talked about, would we want children? And I said, oh, yes. We had sisters and brothers, both of us. Said, well, you know, could you be satisfied with one lady all your life? He said, did you really ask me that? And I had a lady who was a social worker, and she said, Marion, how could you think of so many questions ahead of time? I said, I had two good ears and two good eyes.
Now, speaking of your campus days, Marion, when you were a student at UC, you campaigned for the college prom to be open to all students.
Yes.
What was the story behind that?
Well, it was just one of the many things we found that the black students weren't participating in. And my husband, who was not my husband at the time, he was a young man who was a Walnut Hills graduate, who was stood high in his class, and knew that he went swimming the day before they emptied the water because he was black. Those were things that they knew in those days, you know. And he said, he thought that we should make changes, and he was made president, and I was later invited to be and was elected president of this group, of a group called Quadres, who were working together to help black students acclimate to the university and for hopefully make changes on it that they thought were unfair. Eight years after I graduated, I still went back to talk to the president about the things that I still thought were unfair.
Yeah. It's important to know that when she went there in 1938, that no black students could live on campus.
Yeah.
There was only one campus organization, the University Singers and Players, which was later turned into Quadras. But the fraternities and sororities, there were white fraternities and sororities on campus, but not blacks. And the College of Medicine only took Caucasian students, and CCM was closed to black students, Marion, and they couldn't use the Schmidlap swimming pool. You know, there were lots of things like that Marion's worked to change over the years.
On the issue of getting the college prom open, were you successful eventually in getting that opened up?
Yes, we were told that you wouldn't be comfortable. And Don had gone there with young men to get invitations, and they snatched the invitations and said, "Oh, yes, we will." Daddy said, "So we got the two prettiest girls we could find and went."
Yeah, well, and that was when Don was there. But then when Marion was talking, she took a member of the Board of Trustees down to the Gibson Hotel and several other places because they couldn't find a venue that would accept black and white students at the ball.
Yeah.
And they canceled it that year. They said it was because it was of the war. But it really was because
they... It really wasn't.
No.
That was just maybe a good or bad excuse, depending upon how you're looking at it.
Leadership had a lot to do with what happened there. And at one point, you know, the presidency was selected by the governor of the state and the mayor of the city on alternate years. And when Ted Berry became mayor of the city, I was placed on the board of directors. So this was years after I had graduated. And I found it very interesting because I did get an opportunity to tell Dr. Walters exactly what I was concerned with.
Marion, when you eventually had your own family with Donald, you traveled a lot around the country.
He taught social studies. And
so he felt like that was a good idea.
He said there were too many students in his class who had never even seen the Ohio River, although they lived in Cincinnati. He thought that was awful.
Yeah. What was it like to travel around the U.S. During those days of segregation?
Well, the Urban League had developed a booklet that told us what we had to do in each state. And in some states we had to do one thing, other states we had to do something else. And so whenever we would stop, we would try to stop driving about 4 in the afternoon so we would have an opportunity to look at a place to spend the night. And we never knew what we were going to run up against. And I remember the only one time in my life that I ever intentionally passed for a non-Negro person. And that was, we were in a rainy storm, and we were trying to find a place, and we couldn't find a place. And my husband said to me, "Go in, Marion, and find us a place for the night." I went in, and I found a place for the night, and we spent the night. And the next morning, in the bright sunlight, when the owner saw us getting out, he hastened to fill our water jugs, and we hastened to leave.
you were caught at that point.
Yeah,
he figured you out at that point.
Yes.
One of the things that surprised me in the book was that you mentioned it was actually easier to travel in the South during those days.
Well, you saw what was written.
Okay, so you knew what was it.
You knew what was written. You knew where you were to go and where you were not to go, and it was never comfortable. I often thought about it. If we could change our looks, we could have gone any place. But you couldn't change your look. You knew who you were, you knew, and even though it was maybe not visible to everybody, I felt that ounce of black blood was very important, and I never altered that feeling.
Oh, you were true to yourself.
So I was true to myself.
One of the really interesting things about traveling by car around the country to all the national parks and places in the 40s and 50s was you had to have the Green Book.
Yeah.
But
the Urban League book.
People, the Urban League book, yes. But that people, and I'm amazed how many of my colleagues and friends today have no idea about sundowner towns. And they were all over the country where it said, out of town by dark, or you're in trouble, or, you know, blacks are not allowed here after dark. There were counties in Missouri and in Kansas that at the county line it said no blacks allowed. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you're driving your car, and what are you supposed to do?
So, you know, and these days, something you think you hear about things like that, and you think, really?
Some
Is
of those
that ever
signs,
possible?
Some of those signs were still there in 1960.
Yeah.
There was one in Sunman, Indiana in 1961, still said, no blacks after dark.
All the years that you've known Marion Dodd, but what do you think makes her so unique?
Well, her energy and her consistency, that whatever the problem seems to be, that she's willing to take on the fight. And she's been a very feisty lady for a long time.
Well, and that's the reason in Cincinnati I joined those organizations that knew what it was to be feisty and didn't lose members when we joined.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of being feisty, in 1959 you had a legal battle with Coney Island, didn't you?
Yes, and we won the right.
52.
To,
52.
Yeah, 52, because Martin Luther King wasn't doing openly a lot in the South in those days. But one thing I knew was that when I called to ask if the riot swing, sing and dance song that was used on the radio inviting people to Coney Island didn't mean attendance for my children, there was something wrong about it. And that's what I had done. The kids had said, "Mother, may we go, my boys?" And I said, "I don't know." But I went to the kitchen and closed the door. I didn't want them to hear what might be the conversation. And during the conversation, I said to the young lady, I said, "Now, all children are invited." She said, "Yes." I said, "Well, we are Negroes, and I want to make sure that my children are welcome." And she paused, and then she said very quietly, "No, they can't come. But I don't make the rules." She quickly followed it up. I said, "I know you don't, honey, but I'll find out who does."
And so, she was chair of the NAACP Legislative Committee at that point.
And Mary, you actually showed up at Coney
Island.
Oh,
yes. Listen, I tell you what happened. We called the national office. They sent down an attorney and we met in the basement of the Mance Hotel, the ballroom of the Mance Hotel. I called every black lawyer in town and told them what had happened, and he told us how to establish our legal challenge to this policy. And what he told us, he said, "Have black and a white and a black and a white and a black and white enter. Whites will be admitted, cost only a dime, and the blacks will be refused." And that's exactly what happened. It was the week the week that we're coming up on, July the 4th, Independence Day. And we knew that the blacks were not going to be admitted because at that time they were not invited and not admitted. And we went in. It was a really interesting question that their lawyers, they hadn't really done their homework well. They did not know who I was, and of the 25 people, I go call to maybe 100, men had to be concerned because they might lose their jobs if they were the breadwinners in the home, so it was hard to get men. And I remember one man, Schuyler Smith, and I give him his name because I love him still. He said, "Well, I don't want my wife to go, and I don't want my children to go, but I will go." And every time I see him, and every time I've seen him since, I tell him how much I love him. But the truth of the matter was that was the policy in those days. And everybody who was put on the stand was asked, "Why did you do this? You know, why?" Marion Spencer called me. Marion Spencer called me. So he put me on the stand, and they said, "Mrs. Spencer, why?" Their lawyers had not done their homework. They said to me, "Why would you, a white woman, do such a thing? You must be a communist." And that was, you know, very, very news to my ears. I wasn't knowing a whole lot about communism, but I told them they were wrong on 2 points. I was neither white nor a communist. That was my answer then.
The irony of that was that they did legally get Coney Island open, but that the Skyline, the pool, the big pool is actually in Claremont County.
Yes.
So it didn't apply.
In effect, it took until 55 before Coney Island
first
said.
And there were others who followed me who completed the change, but it was not immediate.
No, they had to file court suit in Claremont County.
Now, what was the legal spat you had with Ken Blackwell in 2004?
Well,
this was over voting rights,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes, this was over voting rights. You know, there was this thought that I think he was making maybe going along well with his leadership, but they were saying that people who were in the polling place had no business being there, and they were questioning the presence of people who were just seated in the polling place. And Al Gerhardstein asked Don and me if we would be plaintiffs, and we said yes, of course. And we went in, and we were asked about it, and we really thought it was wrong to have people just there for fear you were illegally there. I had been voting ever since, as I told you, my grandfather said, vote, from the time I was 21, which we had to be in those days. I never missed a vote. And I did not want to be questioned about my right.
That funny thing about that is they lost the case, but they won the war.
Yeah, because Ken Blackwell, he was Secretary of State at the time. It generated so much national publicity. Didn't he back down?
Yes, he withdrew it.
We changed our mind. Yeah.
And it was all about having non-local observers in the voting place, in black polling places. And Marion said, no, that's not right. And there was such publicity about it that he backed down.
Marion, what's your assessment of race relations and civil rights in the U.S. today? What do you think of the current state of things?
I think we're at a crucial point. I think that there are many things that are happening throughout the country that we are in a position, because of electronics and all, able to see as well as to read and to hear about and to learn about and to understand that we all individually are participants, whether we admit that or not, and that we must, singly and group members together, we should question things that are not right for all people. If they're right for people of one color, they should be right for people of other colors. And we should say to ourselves, well, do I question this? And not be ashamed or afraid or reluctant to question what we are not comfortable with.
Don, what kind of impact do you think that Marion has had on civil rights, not just here in Cincinnati, but nationally?
Well, in civil rights and many, many kinds of rights, actually, she, after Coney Island, one of the next things, she sued the school board, because the school board's attitude was that they were not, in 73, that they were not doing anything to impede integration. Mm-hmm. But she said, well, you need to do more than that. And then she got very involved with the Right to Know legislation about hazardous waste and people working in industrial settings, and they had no idea what the toxic chemicals were that they were working with and whatever. And that's kind of what propelled her to the city council race, was she became well known for that. The passage of the ordinance about Right to Know in Cincinnati led to being copied by 5 other cities in Ohio, and then it was actually picked up in the wording from Cincinnati, was put in the Superfund legislation a few years later, so that's national impact. And she and Donald are members of the Ohio Civil Rights Hall of Fame. There's her list in the back of her book of all the things that she's done. Is very impressive.
What's the message would like people to get from the book?
I would like people to understand the white privilege, that they have no idea. I'm astounded how many people don't know why West Virginia is West Virginia. And that's, you know, when the day
well,
after the election,
yep.
they didn't secede. And then all of the things when Marion and Donald were married, they couldn't go to any hotel or restaurant downtown except one Chinese restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to understand what that history was and why black people have every reason to be very angry. And I think the white population just needs to be a lot better tuned in to the denial of rights that we have perpetuated for so many years.
Hmm. Well, Marion and Dot, it's been a pleasure talking to both of you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
Marion Spencer and Dorothy Christensen. The new book is called Keep On Fighting, The Life and Civil Rights Legacy of Marion A. Spencer. Marion's 95th birthday open house and book signing is going to be tomorrow from 2 until 5 in the afternoon at the First Unitarian Church on Reading Road. For reservations, send an email to marionspencerbooks@gmail.com indicating how many people are in your party and whether you plan to purchase books. And you can also find that email address at wvxu.org. Then Dorothy is going to be doing a reading and book signing at Joseph Beth and Rookwood Commons on July 1st at 7 o'clock in the evening. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our program are available at wvxu.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier. The technical director was Kevin Rawinski. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Science Friday next on 91.7 WVXU. Since its discovery in 1739, Big Bone Lick in Boone County has drawn the attention of naturalists and paleontologists from around the world. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll discuss the revitalization of the birthplace of American paleontology. We'll also take a look at Redbike. The bike sharing service is now available on both sides of the river. And in Focus on Technology, how tech savvy is your pet? That's on Cincinnati Edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.